This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
All external actors, regional and international, need to keep pressure on Burundi for it to live up to its human rights obligations in the country.
That's Mitao Niwaniaki of Amnesty International talking about regional efforts to end the Burundi crisis. Details coming up. Also, South Sudanese rebel leader Riek Machar has returned to the capital, Juba. And Zimbabwe has a cash crisis and banks are allowing only limited withdrawals. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour: 1 year ago today, Burundi broke out into political violence. That's when President Pierre Nkurunziza announced he would stand for a third term in office. His opponents took to the streets to protest his decision, which they said was unconstitutional. Opposition protests and the government's reaction to them grew violent. Hundreds have been killed and more than 250,000 people have fled the country. Today, a UN press conference marked the start of political violence in Burundi's last year. Among those participating were two members of Burundi's civil society, Pierre Clavar Mbonimpima, founder and president of the Association for the Protection of Human Rights and Incarcerated Persons, and Agnes Kiromira Muvira. She's a member of the Burundi Women and Girls Movement for Peace and Security. Mbonimpima, speaking through an English translator, recited statistics showing security in Burundi continues to deteriorate.
So during 2015, 1,098 people were killed, without talking about the one that were tortured, and 800 are missing.
Plus de 5,000 personnes se trouvent en prison arbitrairement.
More than 5,000 people are in jail right now. Each day, each week, each month, we're counting dead. An average of 60 people are killed per month.
Aujourd'hui, la population entière vit dans la peur.
Today, the entire population lives in fear. The security body that was supposed to protect them has been divided. So right now, the population is not secure.
That was human rights activist Pierre Claver in Mbonimpima. His colleague Agnes Kiromira Muvira had equally troubling figures about the plight of women and children, many of whom had been beaten and raped as a form of political punishment.
We have seen since April a constant rise of those cases. We have noted about 120 for last year. The victims are often women and children. And the cases, this is underestimated because the people don't come and report that because of shame, also because of cultural issue. And in December, the morning of December 12, there were so many women that were raped after the violence that took place on December 11. But those numbers are unknown because people didn't come forward to report it. Why are they not reporting? Because of shame, but also because they know that there will not be justice. So the other thing we are very concerned about is the government messages that Burundi is now more or less peaceful, because this is not accurate. How can Burundi be peaceful this time when we know that there is over 250,000 people who are refugee today? 130 people flee the country to Tanzania a day. The same number flee the country during a week to Rwanda. It is estimated that around 150 and 250 per week are leaving for Uganda. Why would these people leave the country if it was peaceful?
Both Burundian human rights activists are asking the United Nations Security Council to send a police force to Burundi to help keep the peace. They say priority should go towards ensuring security in the country while political efforts to end the violence continue. Tanzanian President Benjamin Mkapa is helping to facilitate peace talks between the government in Bujumbura and its opponents. Amnesty International says the citizens of Burundi have paid a high price as their nation's political crisis drags on. Mitao Nyuanyeki is Amnesty Regional Director for the Horn of Africa, East Africa and the Great Lakes region. She spoke with VOA's David Arnold about the violence in Burundi and the role of East African community and the African Union must play to bring the violence to an end.
Within the country, there's quite a lot of fear. There have been many detentions, many disappearances, increasing number of targeted killings, which are hard to attribute to either side, grenade attacks. It's holding steady, but obviously the situation is grim with about 240,000 people across the borders.
The UN has identified 474 people who've been killed. You are also addressing torture and other human rights violations in the country. What can the UN or any other organization do to bring the problem under control?
Well, I think in the first instance, all external actors, regional and international, need to keep pressure on Burundi for it to live up to its human rights obligations in the country. There have been many calls for independent and credible investigations into this slew of detentions, disappearances, killings, and so on in the course of security operations. At the same time, pressure needs to be maintained to bring Burundi to the table in terms of the external mediation under the EAC. The AU backs it. They've tried to invigorate it through the appointment of former President Mkapa of Tanzania to help facilitate the talks. He just announced a resumption early May. All efforts need to be brought to bear for the government of Burundi and the political opposition to sit down and reach some kind of accommodation on this. We hope that promises made by the government of Burundi to the AU around the deployment of human rights monitors will be kept, around the release of political prisoners. And obviously, in this kind of atmosphere of fear, freedom of expression and the media, free media, need to be functioning just to deal with all the rumors, because rumors can make a very tense situation worse.
That was Mitao Nyuanyeki talking to VOA's David Arnold. South Sudanese rebel leader Riek Machar has returned to the capital, Juba, a key step to ending the country's civil war. Machar was sworn in as first vice president and will help form a unity government with President Salva Kiir. A political feud between Kiir and Machar set off South Sudan's conflict in December 2013. Fighting killed tens of thousands of South Sudanese and displaced more than 2 million people. Machar thanked all those responsible for making his return possible. He also thanked the government for its goodwill. He said he and others will push hard to implement the peace agreement and form a transitional unity government. Machar said the second challenge is stabilizing the economy.
With security stabilization, with peace breaking out, we should stabilize the economy. This would be the dividends for the ordinary person. Third, we have a lot of displaced people. They're displaced internally. We also have, even in the capital and state capitals, people who are now under the protection of the UN. We need to reach out to such people. We need to ensure that humanitarian access is done so that humanitarian relief reaches the needy, whether in the rural setup or in the urban setup. This is another major challenge.
That's South Sudan First Vice President Riek Machar speaking upon his arrival today at Juba Airport. You are listening to African News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Fifteen past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Amnesty International says the citizens of Burundi have paid a high price as their nation's political crisis drags on. And South Sudanese rebel leader Riek Machar, after returning to the capital Juba today, was sworn in as first vice president. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Zimbabwe has a cash crisis and banks are limiting the amount of cash that people, especially business owners, can withdraw. That's making it difficult for business owners to pay for products imported from neighboring countries or the salaries of their employees. The Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe says the problem is temporary. However, the government is seeking help from the International Monetary Fund. Reporter Peter Thornycroft is following developments from Johannesburg. She spoke to VOA's Jody Kapawa about Zimbabwe's cash crisis.
It means that Zimbabwe's banks are limiting the withdrawals to its customers, that there's a shortage of everyday cash in the economy. People cannot get hold of enough cash to pay their bills or to even pay their workers or to settle their debt. And I think people may have forgotten that in 2009, Zimbabwe abandoned its own currency, the Zimbabwe dollar, and mainly trades now in United States dollars, which, of course, it doesn't print. And the United States dollar has a much higher value in the region than all of the other local currencies in Mozambique or Botswana, and particularly in South Africa, which uses the South African rand. And South Africa is Zimbabwe's largest trading partner. So Zimbabwe finds it very difficult to export goods these days with the high value of the US dollar against the South African rand. So that is one problem. There's another problem for Zimbabweans in that many of them don't trust the banks. During the hyperinflationary period in Zimbabwe leading to 2009, if you remember, there was no money in the banks, there was no food in the supermarkets, there was almost no trade, there was nothing. And the Zimbabwe government then also took money from people's bank accounts. Their cash savings disappeared, their pension funds disappeared. So people don't trust the banks. And also, a number of domestic banks, locally owned banks, went bankrupt in the last 10 years. There are some queues at some banks and at the post office. There are queues for money, but it's not out of control yet. However, today as we speak, a number of civil servants are being paid, and so there will be a rush on the banks in the next few days, and we suspect that the amount of United States dollars that people can withdraw from their banks will again be more difficult in the next few days.
Now, I see that the Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe is offering some assurances that this won't last very long. When it says that, what does not very long mean?
Well, they're waiting for the earnings from the tobacco crop to come in, and the tobacco sales have begun for this year, and that is the largest export in Zimbabwe, is tobacco. So when those U.S. dollars start emerging into the economy, the banks will be able to afford to buy U.S. dollars overseas and bring them into the banks. They've also got a loan from a bank in Cairo, an African Development Bank in Cairo, where they say they are borrowing $200 million in cash. And on Monday, the Zimbabwe finance minister will be with the IMF in Washington, presenting the IMF with a plan of how it intends to pay its debt of $110 million. If the IMF accepts that, then Zimbabwe will feel a bit more confident that it can resume borrowing from the IMF. It last had a loan from the IMF in 1999.
But when we hear IMF, we often hear about structural reforms. Would the IMF require Zimbabwe to change some things?
Zimbabwe has reformed. It's reformed considerably in the last couple of years. It still has to significantly reduce its civil service, because its civil service eats up about 84% of GDP. And in addition, the IMF has been unhappy about the size of its foreign debt. It's also unhappy with the policy of so-called indigenization, which insisted that 51% of all foreign companies be owned by local black Zimbabweans. Well, that indigenization policy never really came into effect. And in the last couple of weeks, President Robert Mugabe issued a statement more or less squashing the headline-catching parts of indigenization. It's still there, but people are not nearly as worried about it now after he has spoken. So there have been reforms.
That's reporter Peter Thornycroft from Johannesburg. She spoke to VOA's Jody Kepua. Migrants and refugees who have arrived in Greece since March 20th are being returned to Turkey at a very slow pace. The deal between Turkey and the European Union went into effect last month. That agreement aims to stop the flow of migrants to Greece and return new arrivals to Turkey. However, Reuters reports that since the deal went into effect, only 340 people have been returned. Two ferries that left Greece today for Turkey carried only 18 migrants. Migrants and refugees who arrived in Greece after March 20th cannot be returned immediately if they request asylum. Many have done so, but determining who qualifies could take a long time. In related news, more than 181,000 migrants and refugees have entered Europe by sea so far this year. More than 1,200 have died trying to make the journey. While the number of migrants and refugees trying to reach Greece from Turkey has slowed to a trickle, the route from North Africa to Southern Europe is getting busy. For example, nearly 26,000 migrants have arrived in Italy since January, about 7,500 this month alone. Italian officials say more than 1,100 have been rescued on the Mediterranean. Many analysts say defeating terror groups such as Islamic State, Al-Shabaab, and Boko Haram will take more than military might. Texas A&M University Associate Professor of Law, Sahir Aziz, says underlying problems that make countries vulnerable to terrorism also must be addressed. Aziz spoke to senior Middle East reporter Mohammed El-Shenawi about what needs to be done to enhance the international campaign to stop terrorism.
When we talk about terrorism, we have to talk also about development, human development, and desecuritizing counterterrorism. Because right now the conversation is purely through a security lens and how we can violently and physically respond to the violence of these terrorist groups. And those are dealing mainly with the symptoms, not with the underlying social, economic, and political conditions that allow these terrorist groups to easily recruit individuals. So what's missing is a conversation about the causes, which are resolved through development in these conflict zones.
Does repression and reacting to terrorism using military and security measures increase the level of radicalism?
Anytime you have an environment where violence is the currency to resolve disputes, then you should expect it from all parties involved in that environment. So political repression is a form of violence. Silencing free speech, I believe that as long as we allow political repression, which is a form of state violence, to be the means in which the state responds to grievances, then we should expect that the response from non-state actors, unfortunately, will equally be as violent.
Briefly, how do you explain the rise of terrorism in Sinai?
Sinai is at high risk of terrorism, and particularly terrorist groups setting base there, which we are seeing now with Wilayat Sina and other militant groups, for various reasons. First, it is a militarized zone that is not developed, that does not have opportunities for the residents who live there. So there is very little source of income, which makes it easier for terrorist groups to recruit them by paying them a fee or paying them to help hide the terrorists from security forces. Second, the residents, 70% of whom are Bedouin, are discriminated against and treated as a fifth column, and often physically harassed and attacked by security forces. So they then have very little loyalty to the regime. And third, it is a haven for trafficking, human trafficking, arms trafficking, and drug trafficking. And that needs to be addressed by incorporating the residents into the state and into benefiting from the economy so that they do not have an economic incentive to participate in the trafficking, and that they will be willing to work with the security forces to stop the trafficking.
What should be the new thinking of countering terrorism in the age of ISIS, and what role should the U.S. play on that respect?
Well, the United States needs to abandon its policy of supporting dictatorship under the false belief that it will produce more stability. The United States needs to accept the new paradigm that dictatorship provides more instability, produces more violence, and is an unsustainable solution to people's grievances. So I suggest that the United States work more on supporting indigenous democratization and allowing people to self-govern, including electing dictators out of office or forcing them out of office and establishing their own electoral process. But the U.S. policy now, which is to unconditionally support authoritarian regimes, whether they're military regimes, secular regimes, or monarchies, has proven to create more instability than it has peace, and that is not in the best interest of the United States.
That's Texas A&M University Associate Professor of Law, Sahar Aziz. She spoke to VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy. The French news agency reports more violence involving suspected ethnic Fulani herdsmen in southeast Nigeria. AFP quotes police as saying gunmen attacked the Nimbo farming community in Uzo Uwini in Enugu State yesterday. They say 7 people were killed and 6 injured. However, local media report the death toll was much higher. They also report as many as 100 Fulani attacked the community with guns, machetes, and bows and arrows. There's been a string of attacks recently over grazing rights in Nigeria. 2 weeks ago, suspected Fulani gunmen killed at least 15 people and burned down homes in eastern Taraba State. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the sunny side of sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Tuesday on Health Chat, host Lenore Modou discusses World Immunization Week, the progress made on the vaccine front, and the remaining challenges. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. For listeners to call during the show, our telephone number is 202-619-3111. Health Chat this Tuesday at 1730 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Looking for something? Headline news, interviews, analysis. We've got it all on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.